My grandfather stands behind her, his face set hard, distracted, the lenses of his glasses gathering the light from the sky.
"Come back to us, you hear? Come back to us,"
my grandmother says, finishing speaking. I wish I could have heard the words that came before them. Up until now, I have never remembered anything that was spoken to me that night. But now I have something. My four-year-old self doesn't respond. My four-year-old self is too scared. He doesn't understand what is happening, why there is urgency and fear in the eyes of everyone around him. My grandmother pulls me to her, and then she lets go. She stands and turns her back to keep me from seeing her cry. My four-year-old self knows that she is crying, but he doesn't know why. Next is my grandfather, who is covered in sweat, grime, and blood. He has clearly been fighting, and his face is twisted, as though he is straining, ready to fight more, ready to go and do all he can in the struggle to survive. His and the planet's. He drops to a knee as my grandmother did before him. For the first time I look around. Twisted heaps of metal, chunks of concrete, large holes in the ground where the bombs have fallen. Scattered fires, shattered glass, dirt, splintered trees. And in the middle of it all, a single airship, unharmed, the one that we are boarding.
"We gotta go!"
somebody yells out. A man, dark hair and eyes. I don't know who he is. Henri looks at him and nods. The children walk up the ramp. My grandfather fixes me with a hard stare. He opens his mouth to speak. But before the words come, I am again swept away, hurled up through the air, the world below again passing in a blur. I try to make it out, but I am moving too fast. The only discernible sights are the bombs, continually falling, large displays of fire of all colors that sweep through the night sky, and the perpetual explosions that follow. Then I stop again. I am inside of a large, open building that I have never seen before. It is silent. The ceiling is domed. The floor is one great slab of concrete the size of a football field. There are no windows, but the sounds of the bombs still penetrate, echoing off the walls around me. Standing in the very middle of the building, tall and proud, alone, is a white rocket that extends all the way to the apex of the ceiling. Then a door slams open in the far corner. My head snaps around to it. Two men enter, frantic, talking quickly and loudly. All at once, a herd of animals rush in behind the men. 15, give or take, continually changing shape. Some flying, some running, on two legs, then on four. Bringing up the rear, a third man follows, and the door is shut. The first man reaches the spacecraft, opens a sort of hatch on the ship's bottom, and begins ushering the animals in.
"Go! Go! Up and in! Up and in!"
he yells. The animals go, all of them changing their shapes in order to do so. Then the last animal enters, and one of the men pulls himself in. The other two begin throwing bags and boxes up to him. It takes them a good 10 minutes to get everything on board. Then all three scatter around the rocket, preparing it. The men are sweating, moving frantically, until everything is ready. Just before the three of them climb inside the rocket, someone runs up with a bundle that looks like a swaddled child, though I can't see well enough to tell. They take whatever it is and go inside. Then the door snaps shut behind them and is sealed. Minutes pass. The bombs must be just outside the walls now. And then, from nowhere, an explosion occurs inside the building, and I see the beginnings of fire shoot from the bottom of the rocket. A fire that quickly grows, a fire that consumes everything inside the building, a fire that consumes even me. My eyes snap open. I am back home in Ohio, lying in bed. The room is dark, but I can sense that I am not alone. A figure moves, a shadow thrown across the bed. I tense myself to it, ready to snap my lights on, ready to hurl it against the wall.
"You were talking,"
Henri says.
"In your sleep just now, you were talking."
I turn on my lights. He is standing beside the bed, wearing pajama pants and a white t-shirt. His hair is tousled. His eyes are red with sleep. What was I saying?
You said, "Up and in, up and in." What was happening?
I was just on Lorien.
In a dream?
I don't think so. I was there just like before.
What did you see?
I scoot up the bed so my back rests against the wall. The animals, I say.
What animals?
In the spaceship I saw take off. The old one at the museum. In the rocket that left after ours, I watched animals being loaded into it. Not many. 15, maybe? With 3 other Lorik. I don't think they were guard. And something else. A bundle. It looked like a baby, but I couldn't tell.
Why don't you think they were guard?
They loaded the rocket with supplies. 50 or so boxes and duffel bags. They didn't use telekinesis.
Into the rocket inside the museum.
I think it was the museum. It was a large domed building with nothing inside of it but a rocket. I can only assume it was the museum.
Henri nods. If they worked at the museum, then they would have been Sepan.
Loading animals? I say. Animals that could change their shape?
Chimera,
Henri says. What?
Chimera. Animals on Lorien that could change their shape. They were called Chimera.
Is that what Hadley was? I ask, remembering back to the vision I had a few weeks ago. The vision of playing in the yard of my elder's home, when I was lifted in the air by the man wearing a silver and blue suit. Henri smiles.
You remember Hadley?
I nod. I've seen him the way that I've seen everything else.
You're having the visions even when we're not training.
Sometimes.
How often?
Henri, who cares about the visions? Why were they loading animals into a rocket? What was a baby doing with them? Or was it even a baby? Where did they go? What purpose could they possibly have had?
Henri thinks about it a moment.
He shifts the weight of his body to his right leg.
Probably the same purpose we had. Think about it, John. How else could animals repopulate Lorien? They too would have to go to some sort of sanctuary. Everything was wiped out, not just the people, but also the animals and all plant life. Maybe the bundle was just another animal, a fragile one, or maybe a young one.
Well, where would they go? What other sanctuary exists besides Earth?
I think they went to one of the space stations. A rocket with Lorik fuel would have been able to make it that far. Maybe they thought the invasion would be short-lived, and they thought they could wait it out. I mean, they would have been able to live on the space station for as long as their supplies lasted.
There are space stations close to Lorien?
Yes, 2 of them. Well, there were 2 of them. I know for sure the larger of the 2 was destroyed at the same time as the invasion. We lost contact with it less than 2 minutes after the first bomb fell.
Why didn't you mention that before, when I first told you about the rocket?
I had assumed that it was empty, that it went up in the air as a decoy. And I think that if one space station was destroyed, then the other was as well. Their trip, unfortunately, was probably done in vain, whatever their goal was.
But what if they came back when their supplies ran out? Do you think they could survive on Lorien? I ask in desperation. I already know the answer. I already know what Henri will say. But I ask anyway, in order to hold on to some sort of hope that we aren't alone in all this. That maybe, somewhere far away, there are others like us, waiting, monitoring the planet so that they, too, might one day return, and we won't be alone when we go back.
No, there is no water there now. You saw that for yourself. Nothing but a barren wasteland. and nothing can survive without water.
I sigh and scoot back down into the bed. I drop my head onto the pillow. What's the point in arguing? Henri is right, and I know it. I saw it for myself. If the globes that he pulled from the chest are to be trusted, then Lorien is nothing more than wasteland, a dump. The planet still lives, but on the surface, there is nothing. No water, no plants, no life. Nothing but dirt and rocks and the rubble of the civilization that once existed.
"Did you see anything else?" Henri asks.
"I saw us on the day we left. All of us at the airship right before we took off."
"It was a sad day."
I nod. Henri crosses his arms and gazes out the window, lost in thought. I take a deep breath. "Where was your family during it all?" I ask. My lights have been off for a good 2 or 3 minutes, but I can see the whites of Henri's eyes staring back at me.
"Not with me. Not on that day," he says.
We are both silent for a time, and then Henri shifts his weight.
"Well, I better get back to bed," he says,
bringing an end to the conversation.
"Get some sleep."
After he leaves, I lie there thinking of the animals, of the rocket, of Henri's family, and how I'm sure he never got the chance to say goodbye to them. I know I won't be able to go back to sleep. I never can when the images visit me, when I feel Henri's sadness. It must be a thought constantly on his mind, as it would be for anyone who left under the same circumstances, leaving the only home you've ever known, all the while knowing you will never see the people you love again. I grab my cell phone and text Sarah. I always text her when I can't sleep, or she texts me if it's the other way around. Then we'll talk for as long as it takes to become tired. She calls me 20 seconds after I hit the send button. "Hey, you," I answer. "You can't sleep?"
"No."
"What's the matter?" she asks. She yawns on the other end of the line. "Was just missing you is all. Been lying in bed staring at the ceiling for like an hour now." "You're silly. You saw me like 6 hours ago." "I wish you were still here," I say. She moans. I can hear her smile through the darkness. I roll to my side and hold the phone between my ear and the pillow. "Well, I wish I was still there, too." We talk for 20 minutes. The last half of the call is both of us just lying there listening to the other breathe. I feel better after having talked to Sarah, but I find it even harder to fall back asleep.
Chapter 24.
For once, since we arrived in Ohio, things seemed to slow for a time. School ends quietly, and for winter break, we have 11 days off. Sam and his mother spend most of it visiting his aunt in Illinois. Sarah stays home. We spend Christmas together. We kiss when the ball drops at midnight on New Year's Eve. Despite the snow and the cold, or maybe even in retaliation against it, we go for long walks through the woods behind my house, holding hands, kissing, breathing in the chilly air beneath the low gray skies of winter. We spend more and more time together. Not a day passes during that whole break that we don't see each other at least once. We walk hand in hand beneath an umbrella of white, from the snow piled atop the tree branches overhead. She has her camera with her, and occasionally stops to take pictures. Most of the snow on the ground lies undisturbed, aside from the tracks we have made on the walk out. We follow them back now. Bernie Kosar in the lead, darting in and out of the brambles, chasing rabbits into small groves and thickets of thorny bush, chasing squirrels up trees. Sarah wears a pair of black earmuffs. Her cheeks and the tip of her nose are red with the cold, making her eyes look bluer. I stare at her.
"What?"
she asks, smiling. "Just admiring the view." She rolls her eyes at me. For the most part, the woods are dense aside from sporadic clearings we continually stumble upon. I'm not sure how far in any one direction the woods extend, but in all of our walks, we have yet to reach their end.
I bet it's beautiful here in the summer, Sarah says. We can probably picnic in the clearings.
An ache forms in my chest. Summer is still 5 months away, and if Henri and I are here in May, we will have made it 7 months in Ohio. That is very nearly the longest we have ever stayed in one place.
Yeah, I agree.
Sarah looks at me.
What?
I look at her questioningly.
What do you mean, what?
That wasn't very convincing, she says. A mess of crows fly by overhead, squawking noisily.
I just wish it was summer now.
Me too. I can't believe we have to go back to school tomorrow.
Ugh, don't remind me. We enter another clearing, larger than the others, an almost perfect circle, 100 feet in diameter. Sarah lets go of my hand, runs into the middle of it, and drops into the snow, laughing. She rolls to her back and begins making a snow angel. I drop beside her and do the same. The tips of our fingers just barely touch while we make the wings. We get up.
It's like we're holding wings, she says.
Is that possible? I ask.
I mean, how would we fly if we were holding wings?
Of course it's possible. Angels can do anything. Then she turns and nuzzles into me. Her cold face against my neck makes me squirm away from her.
Oh, your face is like ice,
she laughs.
Come warm me up.
I take her in my arms and kiss her beneath the open sky, the trees surrounding us. There are no sounds save the birds and the occasional pack of snow falling from the nearby branches. Two cold faces press tightly together. Bernie Kosar comes trotting up, out of breath, tongue dangling, tail wagging. He barks and sits in the snow staring at us, his head cocked to the side.
Bernie Kosar, were you off chasing rabbits? Sarah asks.
He barks twice and runs over and jumps up on her. He barks again and pushes off and then looks up expectantly. She grabs a stick from the ground, shakes the snow off it, and then hurls it into the trees. He races after it and disappears from sight. He emerges from the trees 10 seconds later, but instead of returning to the clearing where he had exited it, he comes from the opposite side. Sarah and I both spin around to watch him.
How'd he do that? She asks.
Don't know, I say. He's a peculiar dog.
Did you hear that, Bernie Kosar? He just called you peculiar.
He drops the stick at her feet. We walk towards home, holding hands, the day nearing dusk. Bernie Kosar trots beside us the whole way out, his head on a swivel as though ushering us along, keeping us safe from what may or may not lurk in the outer dark beyond our line of sight. 5 newspapers are stacked on the kitchen table, Henri at his computer, the overhead light on.
Anything? I ask out of habit. Nothing more. There hasn't been a promising story in months, which is a good thing, but I can't help but always hope for something every time I ask.
Actually, yes, I think so.
I perk up, then walk around the table and look over Henri's shoulder at the computer screen.
What?
There was an earthquake in Argentina yesterday evening. A 16-year-old girl pulled an elderly man free from a pile of rubble in a tiny town near the coast.
Number 9?
Well, I certainly think she's one of us. Whether she's number 9 or not remains to be seen.
Why? There's nothing really extraordinary about pulling a man from rubble.
Look,
Henri says, and then scrolls to the top of the article. There is a picture of a large slab of concrete, at least 1 foot thick, 8 feet long and wide.
This is what she lifted to save him. It must weigh 5 tons, and look at this,
he says, and scrolls back to the bottom of the page. He highlights the very last sentence. It reads,
Sophia Garcia could not be found for comment. I read the sentence three times. She couldn't be found? I say.
Exactly. She didn't decline to comment. She simply couldn't be found.
How did they know her name?
It's a small town, less than a third the size of Paradise. Most everyone would know her name there.
She left, didn't she? Henri nods.
I think so. Probably before the paper was even published. That's the downfall of small towns. It's impossible to remain unnoticed.
I sigh. Hard for the Mogadorians to go unnoticed, too.
Precisely.
Sucks for her, I say, and stand up. Who knows what she must have left behind? Henri gives me a skeptical look, opens his mouth to say something, but then thinks better of it, and goes back to the computer. I return to my bedroom. I pack my bag with a fresh change of clothes and the books I'll need for the day. Back to school. I'm not looking forward to it, though it'll be nice to see Sam again, whom I haven't seen in nearly 2 weeks. Okay, I say. I'm off.
Have a good day. Be safe out there.
See you this afternoon. Bernie Kosar rushes out of the house ahead of me. He's a ball of energy this morning. I think he's come to look forward to our morning runs, and the fact that we haven't done one in a week and a half has made him chomping at the bit to get back to it. He keeps up with me for most of the run. Once we make it, I give him a good pet and scratch behind his ears. All right, boy, go home, I say. He turns and starts trotting back to the house. I take my time in the shower. By the time I finish, other students are beginning to arrive. I walk the hall, stop by my locker, then go to Sam's. I slap him on the back. It startles him. Then he flashes a big, toothy grin when he sees that it's me.
I thought I was going to have to whip somebody's ass there for a minute, he says.
Just me, my friend. How is Illinois?
Ugh, he says, and rolls his eyes. My aunt made me drink tea and watch reruns of Little House on the Prairie nearly every day.
I laugh. That sounds awful.
It was. Trust me, he says, and reaches into his bag. This was waiting in the mail when we got back.
He hands me the latest issue of They Walk Among Us. I begin flipping through it.
There is nothing on us or the Mogadorians, he says.
Good, I say. They must fear us after you visited them.
Yeah, right.
Over Sam's shoulder, I see that Sarah is coming our way. Mark James stops her in the middle of the hallway and hands her a few sheets of orange paper. Then she continues on her way. Hi, gorgeous, I say when she reaches us. She stands on her toes to kiss me. Her lips taste like strawberry lip balm. Hi, Sam. How are you?
Good. How are you?
He asks. He seems at ease with her now. Before the incident with Henri, which was a month and a half ago, being in Sarah's presence would have made him uncomfortable, and he wouldn't have been able to meet her eye or know what to do with his hands. But now he looks at her and smiles, speaking with confidence. Good, she says. I'm supposed to give you both one of these. She hands us each one of the orange sheets Mark just gave her. It's a party invitation for this upcoming Saturday night at his house.
I'm invited? Sam asks.
Sarah nods. All three of us are. Do you want to go? I ask. Maybe we could give it a shot. I nod. You interested, Sam? He looks past Sarah and me. I turn to see what he is looking at, or rather, who? At a locker across the hall is Emily, the girl who was on the hayride with us, and who Sam has been pining for ever since. When she walks past, she sees that Sam is watching her, and she smiles politely. Emily? I say to Sam.
Emily what?
Sam asks, looking back at me. I look at Sarah. I think Sam likes Emily Knapp.
I do not, he says.
I could ask her to come to the party with us, Sarah says.
Do you think she would go?
Sam asks. Sarah looks at me. Well, maybe I shouldn't invite her, since Sam doesn't like her.
Sam smiles. Okay, fine. I don't know.
She keeps asking why you never called after the hayride. She kind of likes you.
That is true, I say. I've heard her say it.
Why didn't you tell me? Says Sam.
You never asked.
Sam looks down at the flyer.
So it's this Saturday?
Yes.
He looks up at me.
I say we go.
I shrug. I'm in.
Henri is waiting for me when the final bell rings. As always, Bernie Kosar is in the passenger seat, and when he sees me, his tail begins wagging 100 miles an hour. I jump into the truck. Henri puts it into gear and drives away.
There was a follow-up article on the girl in Argentina, Henri says.
And?
Just a short article saying that she has disappeared. The mayor of the town is offering a modest reward for information on her whereabouts. It sounds like they believe she's been kidnapped.
Are you worried about the Mogadorians having gotten to her first?
If she's 9, like the note we found indicated, and the Mogadorians were tracking her, it's a good thing that she vanished. And if she's been captured, then the Mogadorians can't kill her. They can't even hurt her. That gives us hope. The good thing, aside from the news itself, is that I imagine every Mogadorian on Earth has poured into Argentina.
Speaking of which, Sam had the latest issue of They Walk Among Us today.
Was there anything in it?
Nope.
I didn't think there would be. Your levitation trick seemed to affect them rather profoundly.
When we arrive home, I change clothes and meet Henri in the backyard for a day of training. Working while consumed with fire has gotten easier. I don't get as flustered as I did on that first day. I can hold my breath longer, close to 4 minutes. I have more control over the objects I lift, and I can lift more of them at the same time. Little by little, the look of worry I saw on Henri's face during the first days has melted away. He nods more. He smiles more. On the days it goes really well, he gets a crazed look in his eyes, and he raises his arms in the air and yells, "Yes!" as loudly as he can. In that way, I am gaining confidence in my legacies. The rest have yet to come, but I don't think they're far off. And the major one, whatever it will be, the anticipation of it keeps me up most nights. I want to fight. I hunger for a Mogadorian to saunter into the backyard so that I may finally seek revenge. It's an easy day. No fire. Mostly just me lifting things and manipulating them while they are suspended in the air. The last 20 minutes pass with Henri throwing objects at me, sometimes just allowing them to fall to the ground, other times deflecting them in a way that emulates a boomerang, so that they twist in the air and go blazing back towards Henri. At one point, a meat tenderizer flies back so fast that Henri dives face first into the snow to keep from being hit by it. I laugh. Henri does not. Bernie Kosar lies on the ground the whole time watching us, seeming to offer his own encouragement. After we are done, I shower, do my homework, and sit at the kitchen table for dinner. So, there is a party this Saturday that I'm going to go to? He looks up at me, stops chewing.
Whose party?
Mark James's.
Henri looks surprised.
All that's over, I say before he can object.
Well, you know best, I suppose. Just remember what's at stake.
Chapter 25. And then the weather warms. Brisk winds, bitter cold, and continuous snow showers are followed by blue skies and 50-degree temperatures. The snow melts. At first, there are standing puddles in the driveway and the yard, the road wet with the sounds of splashing tires. But after a day, all the water drains and evaporates, and the cars pass as they do on any other day. A lull in the action. A brief reprieve before Old Man Winter takes up the reins again. I sit on the porch waiting for Sarah, staring up at the night sky full of twinkling stars and a full moon. A thin knife-like cloud cuts the moon in two and then quickly disappears. I hear the crunch of gravel under tires, then headlights come into view and the car pulls into the driveway. Sarah gets out of the driver's side. She's dressed in dark gray pants, flared at the ankles, a navy blue cardigan sweater beneath a beige jacket. Her eyes are accentuated by the blue shirt peeking out where the jacket's zipper ends, her blonde hair falling past her shoulders. She smiles coyly and looks at me, fluttering her eyelashes as she approaches. There are butterflies in my stomach. Almost 3 months together, and yet I still grow nervous when I see her. A nervousness that's hard to imagine time will ever assuage. "You look gorgeous," I say. "Well, thank you," she says, and bobs a curtsy. "You don't look so bad yourself." I kiss Sarah on the cheek. Then Henri walks out of the house and waves to Sarah's mom, who is sitting in the passenger seat of the car.
"So you'll call when you're ready to be picked up, right?"
Henri asks me. "Yes," I say. We walk to the car, and Sarah gets behind the wheel. I sit in the back. She's had her learner's permit for a few months now, which means she can drive so long as a licensed driver sits in the passenger seat beside her. Her actual driver's test is on Monday, 2 days away. She's been anxious about it ever since making the appointment over winter break. She backs out of the driveway and pulls away, eventually flipping the visor down, then smiling at me through the mirror. I smile back.
"So how is your day, John?"
Her mother turns and asks me. We make small talk. She tells me of the trip to the mall that the two of them made earlier in the day, and how Sarah drove. I tell her about playing with Bernie Kosar in the yard, and about the run we went on after. I don't tell her about the training session that lasted for 3 hours in the backyard after the run. I don't tell her how I split the dead tree's trunk straight down the middle through telekinesis, or how Henri threw knives at me that I deflected into a sandbag 50 feet away. I don't tell her about being lit on fire or the objects that I lifted and crushed and splintered. Another kept secret. Another half-truth that feels like a lie. I would like to tell Sarah. I somehow feel that I'm betraying her by keeping myself hidden. And over the last few weeks, the burden has really begun to weigh on me. But I also know I have no other choice. Not at this point, anyhow.
"So it's this one?" Sarah asks.
"Yes," I say. She pulls into Sam's driveway. He paces at the end of it, dressed in jeans and a wool sweater. He looks up at us with a deer caught in the headlights blank stare. There is gel in his hair. I'd never seen gel in his hair before. He walks to the side of the car, opens the door, and slides in beside me.
"Hi, Sam,"
Sarah says, then introduces him to her mom. Sarah reverses the car out of the driveway and pulls onto the road. Both of Sam's hands are planted firmly on the seat in nervousness. Sarah turns down a road I've never seen before and makes a right turn into a winding driveway. 30 or so cars are parked along the side of it. At the end of the driveway, surrounded by trees, is a large two-story house. We can hear the music well before we reach the house.
"Geez, nice house," Sam says.
"You guys be good in there," Sarah's mom says. "And be safe. Call if you need anything, or if you can't get a hold of your father," she says, looking at me.
"Will do, Mrs. Hart," I say.
We get out of the car and begin walking to the front door. Two dogs run up to us from the side of the house, a golden retriever and a bulldog. Their tails are wagging, and they're sniffing spastically at my pants, smelling the scent of Bernie Kosar. The bulldog is carrying a stick in his mouth. I wrestle it away from him and throw it across the yard, and both dogs sprint after it.
Dozer and Abby, Sarah says.
I take it Dozer is the bulldog? I ask. She nods and smiles at me, as though in apology. I'm reminded how well she must know this house. I wonder if it's odd for her to be back now, with me.
This is a horrible idea, Sam says.
He looks at me.
I'm only now realizing that.
Why do you think so?
Because, only 3 months ago, the guy who lives here filled both our lockers with cow manure and hit me in the back of the head with a meatball during lunch. And now we're here.
I bet Emily is already here, I say, and nudge him with my elbow. The door opens into the foyer. The dogs come rushing in past us and disappear into the kitchen, which lies straight ahead. I can see that Abby is now holding the stick. We're met with loud music that we have to yell over to be heard. People are dancing in the living room. There are cans of beer in most of their hands. A few people drinking bottled water or soda. Apparently, Mark's parents are out of town. The whole football team is in the kitchen, half of them wearing their Letterman jackets. Mark comes up and hugs Sarah. Then he shakes my hand. He holds my gaze for a second and then looks away. He doesn't shake Sam's hand. He doesn't even look at him. Perhaps Sam is right. This may have been a mistake.
Happy you guys could make it. Come on in. Beer's in the kitchen.
Emily stands in the far corner talking to other people. Sam looks her way, then asks Mark where the bathroom is. He points the way.
Be right back, Sam says to me.
Most of the guys are standing around the island in the middle of the kitchen. They look at me when Sarah and I enter. I look at each of them in turn, and then grab a bottle of water from the ice bucket. Mark hands Sarah a beer and opens it for her. The way he looks at her makes me realize yet again just how little I trust him. And I realize now just how bizarre the whole situation is, me being in his house now with Sarah, his ex-girlfriend. I'm happy that Sam is with me. I reach down and play with the dogs until Sam comes out of the bathroom. By then, Sarah has made her way to the corner of the living room and is talking to Emily. Sam tenses beside me when he realizes that there is nothing else for us to do but walk up to them and say hello. He takes a deep breath. In the kitchen, two of the guys have lit a corner of the newspaper on fire for no other reason than to watch it burn. Make sure you compliment Emily, I say to Sam as we approach. He nods.
There you guys are, Sarah says. I thought you had left me all by my lonesome.
Wouldn't dream of it, I say.
Hi, Emily. How are you?
I'm good,
she says, then to Sam.
I like your hair.
Sam just looks at her. I nudge him. He smiles.
Thank you, he says. You look very nice.
Sarah gives me a knowing look. I shrug and kiss her on the cheek. The music has grown even louder. Sam talks to Emily, somewhat nervously, but she laughs, and after a while, he eases a little.
So are you okay? Sarah asks me.
Of course. I'm with the prettiest girl at the party. How could things be better?
Oh, shush, she says and pokes me in the stomach.
The four of us dance for an hour or so. The football players keep drinking. Somebody shows up with a bottle of vodka, and not long after that, one of them, I don't know which, throws up in the bathroom so that the smell of vomit wafts throughout the whole downstairs. Another one passes out on the living room sofa, and some of the others draw with a marker on his face. People keep filtering in and out of the doorway leading to the basement. I have no idea what is going on down there. I haven't seen Sarah for the past 10 minutes. I leave Sam and walk through the living room and the kitchen, then walk up the stairs. White, thick carpet. walls lined with art and family portraits. Some of the bedroom doors are open. Some are closed. I don't see Sarah. I walk back downstairs. Sam is standing sullenly by himself in the corner. I walk over to him. "Why the long face?" I ask. He shakes his head. "Don't make me lift you in the air and turn you upside down like the guy in Athens." I smile. Sam doesn't.
"I just got cornered by Alex Davis," he says.
Alex Davis is another of Mark James's brood, a wide receiver for the team. He's a junior, tall and thin. I've never talked to him before, and likewise know little else about him. "What do you mean by cornered?"
"We just talked. He saw that I've been talking to Emily. I guess they dated over the summer."
"So what? Why does that bother you?"
He shrugs. "It just sucks. But it bothers me, okay?"
"Sam, do you know how long Sarah and Mark dated?"
"For a long time."
"2 years," I say.
"Does it bother you?"
he asks. "Not in the least. Who cares about her past? Besides, look at Alex," I say and nod to him standing in the kitchen. He is slumped against the kitchen counter, his eyes aflutter, a thin layer of sweat glistening on his forehead. "Do you really think she misses being with that?" Sam looks at him, shrugs. "You're a good dude, Sam Good. Don't get down on yourself."
"I'm not down on myself."
"Well, then don't worry about Emily's past. We don't have to be defined by the things we did or didn't do in our past. Some people allow themselves to be controlled by regret. Maybe it's a regret, maybe it's not. It's merely something that happened. Get over it." Sam sighs. He's still wrestling with it. "Go on, she likes you. There's nothing to be scared of," I say.
"I am, though."
"Best way to deal with fear is to confront it. Just walk up to her and kiss her.
I bet she kisses you back."
Sam looks at me and nods, then goes to the basement, where Emily is hanging out. The two dogs come wrestling into the living room, tongues dangling, tails wagging. Dozer drops his chest to the ground and waits for Abby to come near enough, and then he jumps at her, and she jumps away. I watch them until they disappear up the stairs, playing tug-of-war with a rubber toy. It's a quarter till midnight. A couple is making out on the couch across the room. The football players are still drinking in the kitchen. I'm starting to get sleepy. I still can't find Sarah. Just then, one of the football players comes rushing up the basement stairs, a crazed, frantic look in his eyes. He rushes to the kitchen sink, turns on the water as high as it will go, and begins throwing open the kitchen cupboard doors.
"There's a fire downstairs,"
he says to the guys nearby. They begin filling pots and pans with water, and one by one they rush down the stairs. Emily and Sam come up the stairs. Sam looks shaken. "What's wrong?" I say.
"The house is on fire."
"How bad?"
"Is any fire good? And I think we started it. We knocked a candle into a curtain."
Sam and Emily both look disheveled and have clearly been making out. I make a mental note to congratulate Sam later. "Have you seen Sarah?" I ask Emily. She shakes her head. More guys rush up the stairs, Mark James with them. There is fear in his eyes. For the first time, I smell smoke. I look at Sam. "Go outside," I say. He nods and takes Emily's hand and they leave together. Some of the others follow, but some stay where they are, watching with drunken curiosity. A few people stand around, stupidly patting the football players on the back as they rush up and down the basement stairs, cheering them on as though it's all a joke. I go to the kitchen and grab the largest thing left, a medium-sized metal pot. I fill it with water and then go downstairs. Everybody has evacuated, aside from us battling the blaze, which is far bigger than I expected. Half the basement is consumed in flames. Dousing it with the little water I have left is completely futile. I don't try, and instead drop the pot and dash back up. Mark comes flying down. I stop him in the middle of the stairway. His eyes are swimming in booze, but through it, I can see that he is terrified, that he is desperate. Forget about it, I say. It's too big. We have to get everyone out. He looks down the stairs at the fire. He knows that what I've said is true. The tough guy front is gone. There is no more pretending.
Mark!
I yell. He nods and drops the pot, and we go back up together.
Everybody out! Now!
I yell when I get to the top of the stairs. Some of the drunker ones don't move. Some of them laugh. One person says,
Where's the marshmallows?
Mark slaps him across the face.
Get out!
He screams. I rip the cordless phone from the wall and shove it into Mark's hand.
Dial 911!
I yell over the loud voices and the music that still blares from somewhere like a soundtrack to the erupting pandemonium. The floor is getting warm. Smoke begins to billow up from beneath us. Only then do people take it seriously. I start pushing them towards the door. I dart past Mark as he begins dialing and rush through the house. I take the stairs three at a time and kick through the open doors. One couple is making out in a bed. I yell at them both to get out. Sarah's nowhere to be found. I sprint back down the stairs and through the door into the dark, cold night. People are standing around, watching. Some of them I can tell are excited by the prospect of the house burning down. Some laugh. I can feel myself begin to panic. Where is Sarah? Sam stands at the back of the crowd, which must total 100 people. I run to him. Have you seen Sarah? I ask.
No, he says. I look back at the house. People are still coming out. The basement windows glow red, flames licking against the panes of glass. One of them is open. Black smoke pours out of it and floats high in the air. I weave through the crowd. Just then, an explosion rattles the house. All the basement windows shatter. Some of the people cheer. The flames have reached the first floor, and they're moving fast. Mark James stands at the front of the crowd, unable to divert his gaze away from it. His face is illuminated by the orange glow. There are tears in his eyes, a look of despair, the same look that I saw in the eyes of the Lorik on the day of the invasion. What an odd thing it must be to watch everything you've ever known be destroyed. The fire spreads with hostility, with disregard. All Mark can do is watch. Flames are beginning to rise up past the first floor windows. We can feel the heat on our faces from where we stand. Where's Sarah? I ask him. He doesn't hear me. I shake him by the shoulder. He turns and looks at me with a blankness that suggests he still doesn't believe what his own eyes are telling him. Where's Sarah? I ask again.
I don't know,
he says. I start to weave through the crowd looking for her, getting more and more frantic. Everyone is watching the blaze. The vinyl siding has begun to bubble and melt. The curtains in the windows have all burned away. The front door stands open, smoke pouring out of the top of it like an upside-down waterfall. We can see all the way into the kitchen, which is an inferno. On the left side of the house, the fire has reached the second floor, and that's when we all hear it. A long, terrible scream, and dogs barking. My heart drops. Every person there strains to listen, while hoping like hell we didn't hear what we all know we did. And then it comes again. Unmistakable. It comes in a torrent, and this time, it doesn't let up. Gasps filter throughout the crowd.
Oh, no,
Emily says.
Oh, God, no. Please, no.
Chapter 26. Nobody speaks. All eyes are wide open, staring up in shock. Sarah and the dogs must be somewhere in the back. I close my eyes and lower my head. All I can smell is the smoke.
Just remember what's at stake,
Henri had warned. I know damn well what's at stake. but still his voice echoes. My life, and now Sarah's life. There is another scream. Terrified. Severe. I feel Sam's eyes on me. He has seen firsthand my resistance to fire. But he also knows how I am hunted. I glance around. Mark is on his knees, rocking himself back and forth. He wants it over with. He wants the dogs to stop barking, but they don't stop. And he takes each bark as though being stabbed in the gut with a knife. Sam, I say so that only he can hear. I'm going in. He closes his eyes, takes a deep breath, fixes me with a stare.
Go get her, he says.
I hand him my phone and tell him to call Henri if for some reason I don't make it out. He nods. I begin moving to the back of the crowd, weaving in and out of the mass of bodies. Nobody pays me any attention. When I finally reach the back, I make a mad dash for the yard's perimeter and then sprint to the rear of the house so that I can enter without being seen. The kitchen is completely submerged in flame. I watch it for a brief moment. I can hear Sarah and the dogs. They sound closer now. I take a deep breath, and with that breath, other things come. Anger. Determination. Hope. And fear. I let them in. I feel them all. And then I lunge forward and sweep across the yard and burst into the house. I am swallowed by the inferno immediately, hearing nothing but the crackle and hum of the flames. My clothes catch fire. There is no end to the blaze. I move to the front of the house and half of the stairs have burned away. What is left is on fire, looking brittle, but there isn't time to test them. I rush up, but they collapse under my weight when I reach the halfway point. I tumble down with them, the fire rising as though someone has stoked the flames. Something pierces my back. I grit my teeth, still holding my breath. I stand from the rubble and listen to Sarah screaming. She's screaming, and she's scared, and she's going to die. Die a hideous, miserable death if I don't get to her. Time is short. I'll have to jump to the second floor. I jump and grab hold of the edge of the floor and pull myself up. The fire has spread to the other side of the house. She and the dogs are somewhere to my right. I leap down the hallway, checking rooms. The pictures on the walls have burned in their frames. Nothing more than blackened silhouettes melted to the wall. Then my foot falls through the floor, and my breath catches in surprise, and I breathe in. Nothing but smoke and flame enter. I begin coughing. I cover my mouth with my arm, but it does little to help. Smoke and fire are burning my lungs. I drop to a knee, coughing, gasping. Then a fury surges through me, and I stand back up, and I move on, hunched over, gritting my teeth, determined. And then I find them, in the last room on the left. Sarah is screaming, "Help!" The dogs are whining and crying. The door is closed, and I kick it open, send it flying off its hinges. All three of them are huddled as tightly against one another as far into the corner as they can get. Sarah sees me and yells my name and starts to stand. I motion to her to stay where she is, and as I step into the room, a huge flaming support beam falls between us. I raise my hand and send it upwards, crashing through what remains of the roof. Sarah seems confused by what she's just seen. I leap towards her, covering 20 feet in a single bound, moving straight through the flames without them affecting me at all. The dogs are at her feet. I push the bulldog into her arms and pick up the retriever. With my other arm, I help her stand.
"You came," she says.
"No one and nothing will ever hurt you as long as I'm alive," I say back to her. Another huge beam falls and takes out part of the floor, landing in the kitchen below us. We need to get out the back of the house so no one sees me, or sees what I think I'm going to need to do. I hold Sarah tight against my side and the dog against my chest. We take 2 steps, then leap over the flaming chasm created by the falling beam. As we start to move down the hall, a huge explosion below takes out most of it. The hallway is gone. Where it used to be are a wall and a window, quickly being consumed by flames. Our only chance is through the window. Sarah is screaming again, clutching my arm, and I can feel the dog's claws digging into my chest. I lift my hand towards the window, stare at it, and focus, and it blows out of its frame, leaving us the opening we need. I look at Sarah, pulling her securely against my side. "Hold on tight," I say. I take three steps and dive forward. The flames swallow us whole, but we fly through the air like a bullet, heading straight towards the opening. I'm worried we're not going to make it. We barely clear it, and I feel the edge of the shattered frame scrape against my arms and the tops of my legs. I hold Sarah and the dog as best I can and twist my body so that I'll land on my back and everyone else will be on top of me. We hit the ground with a thud. Dozer goes rolling. Abby yelps. I hear the breath go out of Sarah. We're about 30 feet behind the house. I feel a cut on the top of my head from the broken glass of the window. Dozer is the first one up. He seems fine. Abby is a little slower. She limps on her front paw, but I don't think it is anything serious. I lie on my back and hold Sarah. She is starting to cry. I can smell her singed hair. Blood drips down the side of my face and gathers in my ear. I sit in the grass to catch my breath. Sarah is in my arms. The bottoms of my shoes have melted. My shirt has completely burned away, and so have most of my jeans. Small cuts traverse the length of both arms, but I am not burned at all. Dozer walks over and licks my hand. I pet him. "You're a good boy," I say between Sarah's sobs. "Go on. Get your sister and go back up front." There are sirens in the distance that should be here within the next minute or two. The woods are about 100 yards from the back of the house. Both dogs sit watching me. I nod to the front of the house, and they get up, as if they understand and both begin walking that way. Sarah is still in my arms. I turn her so she is cradled in them, and I stand and head to the woods, carrying her as she cries on my shoulder. Just as I enter them, I hear the whole crowd erupt in cheers. Dozer and Abby must have been seen. The woods are dense. The full moon still shines, but there is little light coming from it. I turn my hands on so we can see. I start to shiver. Panic sweeps through me. How will I explain this to Henri? I'm wearing what now look like singed cutoffs. My head is bleeding, so is my back, along with various cuts on my arms and legs. My lungs feel as though they are on fire with every breath I take. And Sarah is in my arms. She now must know what I can do, what I am capable of, or at least some of it. I'm going to have to explain everything to her. I'll have to tell Henri she knows. I already have too many strikes against me. He'll say someone will slip at some point. He'll insist we leave. There's no way around it. I set Sarah down. She stopped crying. She looks at me, confused, scared, bewildered. I know I need to get some clothes and get back to the party so that people aren't suspicious. I need to get Sarah back so people don't think she's dead. "You're okay to walk?" I say.
"I think so."
"Follow me."
"Where are we going?"
"I need to get some clothes. Hopefully one of the football players has a change of clothes for after practice." We start walking through the woods. I'm going to circle around and look inside people's cars for something to wear.
"What just happened, John? What is happening?"
"You were in a fire and I got you out of it."
"What you did isn't possible."
"It is for me."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
I look at her. I had hoped never to have to tell her what I'm about to tell her. even though I knew it probably wasn't realistic. I had hoped to stay hidden in paradise. Henri has always said never to get too close.